Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. On the eve of the release of the state's economic report and forecast, we sit down with the state's chief economist to talk about stories behind some of those numbers. We take a closer look at Hawaii Gas and the calls for more transparency about greenhouse gas emissions. We jump into a hemp house and talk to a builder and a homeowner of one of the first homes built of what has been described as Mary Jane's sober cousin. We talk about the possibilities of industrial hemp in Hawaii. And is your lower back aching? What you can do to help yourself? A physical therapist offers tips in a new book. It is Wednesday, September 4th. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, the state's chief economist, Eugene Tion, stopped by our studios to talk about numbers. The Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, DBET, as it is often called, is about to release its latest economic report and forecast. It's based in part on the information collected in the 2023 data book, a treasure trove of trends in the state. Stay with me now. I don't want your eyes to glaze over. There are some fascinating stories in those numbers. Tion gives us the context of one of my favorite books, which the state has been compiling for almost 60 years.
The data book has 24 chapters, including almost everything. It's 845 tables. And in terms of pages, it's 1,187 pages. It's huge. I actually have only two chapters here. You can see
wow.
how big it is.
Yeah, but it's a few inches deep there.
Yeah, it is actually in electronic form, and people can download as a PDF or Excel file.
I remember the old days when it was, you know, you could go down there and pick up your copy.
Yes.
It's hefty.
Yeah, since about 2000, we don't produce a hard copy. We upload as electronic copy. So for this 2023 data book, there are a lot of things. I think the interesting part, or maybe the significant part, I think it is on the population. So I think the population is very important in several ways. And we have seen when the population increase or decrease, that impact our labor force, impact our housing, and also impact our economic growth. Because for economy to grow, we call sustainable growth, for long-term growth, you need three things. One, you need labor. You need the people, labor force. And secondly, you need capital. You need investment. Buildings, freeways, you know, factories. Then thirdly, which may be the most important, you need technology, like the AI, like, you know, all the others. They will improve. You have those facilities, you have the people, but then you have to have the productivity. They have to be able to produce efficiently. So that is technology. But I think one of the three is labor. So what I see from is especially the chapter one, which is population, I see there are changes in recent years. I think the change mostly we lost population in the last 5 years, and we lost about 5,000 each year. Yeah, since 2019 and 20, 21, 22, 23, 24 December, we will have a number by the middle of December. And I would assume 24 will still lose population.
For the last 5 years, we've been losing 5,000 people.
Each year, yeah. So 5 years total is about 25,000.
So we have lost 25,000 since COVID.
Yes, because our state is small. You know, we lost 25,000 is a big number. We actually lost about 10,000 each year to the mainland, and we gained about 5,000 from the international migration. then at a net, we still lost 5,000 each year.
And so how do we grapple with this? I mean, this is good information to have for our policymakers to make the best decisions when we have projects come up, when we try and forecast, you know, what parts of the economy do we need to shore up for our future?
I think this, as I said, it will impact our labor force and also impact our housing demand. But the demand is mostly, we call it pent-up demand. Pent-up demand means that we have a lot of people doubling up with their parents. They cannot afford their own homes. So, but if the price is right, and if the income is right, they would like to have their own homes. I think that is, we call, especially for comers from outside of US, we call the American dream. So I think this population reduction will reduce the demand a little bit, but the most of demand is still pent-up demand. We still have a lot of people doubling up. With Hawaii is actually is the most crowded state in the nation. And one, we have a smaller space in terms of
square footage.
Square footage, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Living square footage.
Yeah, yeah. We are the least. And in terms of number of people, we are the highest. So the two combined, it shows that we are the most crowded among the state. How to resolve this? You need to build more homes. And I think the keyword is affordable. So you have to build the homes that people can should be able to buy so that we increase the ownership. They have their own space. And then mainly we will keep them here. One of the main factors people moving to the mainland is the housing price.
We often hear, oh gosh, our real property tax is the lowest rate in the country. But yeah, I guess if you had more homes, you could increase that base, you know, so that you could get more income into the city coffers to pay for the basics.
Yes, I think in terms of one of the factors is the cost of living. You know, housing costs is the major because our people, Hawaii people, we spend 40% of our income on housing, while the nation on average, they spend 30%. So we spend 10 percentage more than the nation. Although our property tax is low, but our other tax is high. You think about, you know, our general excise tax is 4% now.
Right. And it's not everything. Food, right?
Exactly.
Clothing. Yeah.
Exactly. You are right. Because it's everything included, including the intermediate sales between industries is also taxed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to ask because, you know, we did have the wildfires and that may have led to an exodus of people because there just weren't enough units on Maui, you know, or here. And so they may have, folks may have moved to the mainland. That happened in August of last year. And hopefully we'll get a better sense, you know, when we get the numbers at the end of the year as to, you know, what happened this year.
Yeah, exactly. By the middle of December, we should have a number and that will show how many people moved out of state, so between Hawaii and the mainland. Currently, because the number is compiled by the U.S. Census Bureau, we don't have that number yet. But I think according to the labor force, we look at the statewide labor force in Maui, we do see we have a reduction in labor force, which means compared with the beginning of the year, especially compared with, you know, pre-wildfire, our labor force is actually decreasing. That is one of the indications that we lost population.
And so where do you get your numbers to be able to track what's going on over there in Maui due to the fires?
My office, actually, we have two branches, which means two offices. They actually collect data, two areas of data. I think one is the labor. So every month, we report the labor market statistics. For example, how many people are working, how many people are still looking for jobs, which industry hired the most people, which industry has the most vacancies, and what is the unemployment rate.
So the labor department is where you get the best numbers?
It's actually, you would think this statistics is collected by the Labor Department, but it's actually collected by my office.
Oh, your office.
It is the
okay.
DBET.
All right.
It is.
Give credit where credit's due.
It was with the Labor Department before 2021, But since 2021, the program moved to my program.
I see.
To my division. So it is now under debate.
Okay.
So that is one area of the data collection. The other area our office also collect is the visitor data. We actually collect it on a daily basis. How many passengers we bring here, all the airlines,
the airlift.
Airlift
capacity. Yeah.
Then on a monthly, we collect the visitors. When you're coming back from the U.S. mainland, you need to fill in an agriculture
form.
Mm-hmm. At the back, I think we have about 70% of the people, not everybody, but 70% of the people, they fill in the form and they tell us which island they visited, you know, which accommodation they use.
So you track it that way?
Yeah, we track that way.
Okay, all right. Anything else that you can share on the tourism front that you've been able to glean?
Yeah, we do see this year the tourism is weak because the U.S. is weakening, but they are still better than 2019. The U.S. visitors are still the largest visitor groups for Hawaii, but they are not as big as 2022. Mainly is because of the exchange rate.
Right, right.
And we have the Japanese recovery is much lower than we expected.
We're hearing that maybe that recovery won't happen until 2027, maybe?
That's correct. Actually, we are going to release our economic forecast tomorrow. So I think our forecast is that this year we are going to decrease in visitor arrivals. We have been decreasing in the last 7 months. Will be decreasing, but the U.S. visitor will be still higher than the 2019 level. But the Japanese recovery is only about 45.2%.
Okay.
At the beginning of the year, we expect Japanese visitor recovery will be about 60% from 2019, but it didn't happen.
Okay, not as strong. Gosh, so any other tidbits? I mean, you're teasing us. You're going to release this report tomorrow. Anything else you can share with us?
Yeah, I think the population-wide, it will be a decrease for this year. And I think it's pretty weak for the tourism for this year, but we expect it will pick up next year. And the reason is the exchange rate is going to be better. So the recovery mostly will be happening in the Japan market.
That was Eugene Tian, Hawaii's chief economist. He shares that the gap between birth and death rates is narrowing, and he thinks within 5 years there could be more deaths as the snapshot on the Big Island is right now. Hawaii's population is the seventh oldest in the country, and if we want to see the population grow, he says it will likely come in the way of people from out of state moving to the islands. We will have links to the Hawaii Data Book for 2023 on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
The Paralympics are underway in Paris, and one athlete to watch is the returning champion Oksana Masters. She's won 17 medals for Team USA, but she dedicates her victories to her native home of Ukraine.
It's no longer just about me chasing a gold medal. I'm on the start line representing Ukraine.
We'll have her story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1, here on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Island Community Health Center, committed to providing health care to all on Hawaii Island. Learn more about how to support the island's community health at hicommunityhealthcenter.org.
You know, we hear a lot in the headlines these days about electricity providers, but today we're looking at gas, specifically Hawaii gas. Here to talk about that is HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I'm guessing we're talking about this because the company is going in for a rate hike?
Yeah, so the company submitted a request to the PUC for the Public Utilities Commission to consider a rate increase in May, and they opened that docket and expanded it in July. And the thing about these rate hearings is they're public forums. So if folks intervene on the rate hearings, then they can go to the PUC and they can ask questions of Hawaii Gas that Hawaii Gas has to respond to, and the PUC then has to consider in terms of its decision making. And so Henry Curtis is the head of Life of the Land, an environmental group that does a lot of work on environmental issues at the PUC, and they're using this rate case as kind of a backdoor to talk to about something that they have been raising concerns over for a while, and that's Hawaii Gas's emissions. So they want Hawaii Gas to try to provide more transparency on what their emissions have been over the last 10 years. They tried to do this before. Here's Henry Curtis, head of Life of the Land.
Life of the Land intervened in the previous rate case back in 2017. We want to discuss greenhouse gases. The Public Utilities Commission refused to do so. We appealed to the Hawaii Supreme Court. They ruled in our favor and remanded it back to the PUC. And at the PUC, we decided that it was probably not the right docket. The PUC had just opened up a new docket to look at exploring Hawaii Gas's long-range plans. And that would involve a lot more players, and it would involve a lot more issues. So we figured that that was the more appropriate docket to look at greenhouse gas emissions. However, that docket has gone absolutely nowhere. And therefore, we need to intervene in this docket to make sure there's a full-on discussion on Hawaii Gas's greenhouse gas emission solutions or non-solutions.
So what is this watchdog group looking for exactly?
Right. So Henry wants specifically a trend line showing the gas company's life cycle greenhouse gas emissions over the last decade, so we can see whether or not they're going up or down, as well as a rock solid commitment from the gas company that says we are going to reduce our emissions in the future.
And so this information that they're looking for, it's not already readily available?
So after I spoke with Henry, I went looking for the data myself. And the gas company, if you go to Hawaii Gas's website, has two sustainability reports, one from 2021 and one from 2022. And those reports include annual emissions data from that year. So in 2021, they reportedly emitted about 61,000 metric tons of greenhouse gases. And that increased in 2022 to 68,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. But without data from additional years, we can't really tell if their emissions are trending up or trending down overall, because COVID in 2021 and 2020 was kind of a weird blip, right? It made everything a little bit funky. So a lot of emissions data was lower in those years than it would have been otherwise. So we really need to get a bigger picture to understand what's happening with Hawaii Gas. And after poking around on their website, I wrote to Hawaii Gas directly and I said, hey, do you have any other sustainability reports? Is data on your emissions publicly available anywhere else? Also, how do you feel about Life of the Land intervening again on your rate case? And they did not respond to my questions about data, but they did say they have received Life of the Land's motion to intervene, and they will be filing a response in accordance with the PUC's rules. They also pointed out that Hawaii Gas represents less than 1% of the state's emissions. And when they're talking about emissions reduction, they directed me to their integrated resource plan, which has been filed with the PUC. That's the docket that Henry, in that previous bite, said went nowhere, and that's why he's trying to restart this conversation. And he isn't convinced by the plans that Hawaii Gas has put forward so far.
Hawaii Gas introduced hydrogen into their gas pipeline back in the 1970s, which decreased the amount of fossil fuel they were using. But since 1970s, in the past half century, they've done very little to decrease their greenhouse gas emissions. So we believe that all major emitters of greenhouse gases should be working towards a common goal of reducing emissions. Hawaii Gas points out that they're only a small player. But when you consider there are billions of sources of greenhouse gases on this planet, everybody's a small player. But we all collectively have to reduce our emissions to make the place better, to make Hawaii and the rest of the world more survivable.
And so a decision on this rate case, would we have a sense as to, you know, when Hawaii Gas wants to hike the rates?
So the Public Utilities Commission still has to announce public hearings. When there's a rate case, there has to be the opportunity for the public to participate. They'll be announcing that shortly. And Henry Curtis said, hey, this is a great opportunity to ask these kinds of questions. If you have any questions about the rate hike or other things that are happening with our utilities, the Public Utilities Commission has these public forums that are available for folks to bring those questions and have them hopefully answered.
Okay, and then how much of a rate hike are we talking about? Is it modest?
The rate hike is significant. Last I checked, I believe it was 17.7%. There still has to be a lot of conversation in that docket and in the from the consumer advocate and any other interveners, including Life of the Land, about what the rate hike will ultimately end up being. Henry Curtis says, we are concerned about the rate hike, but Life of the Land's real work in this docket is to get Hawaii Gas to provide some information about their emissions.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate you tracking this, Savannah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pope talking to us about a call for Hawaii Gas to release more data about its emissions and impact on our environment.
September is Classical Music Month, and HPR2 is celebrating with a top 100 list of your favorite compositions. Tell us your favorites, and you'll be entered into our drawing for Hawaii Symphony Orchestra tickets or our new HPR2 day bag. Tune in to HPR2, September 18th through the 27th, to find out if your favorites made the list. Submit your picks by this Friday. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/classicalmonth.
Some colleges receive tens of thousands of applications every year, so they're looking for a faster way to process them. That's why some admissions offices are now using AI.
For instance, summarizing students' essays and recommendation letters, using AI to either highlight or call out specific points.
AI and college admissions, that's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Today, we're taking a closer look at the possibilities for industrial hemp in Hawaii Nei. This week, HPR's Mark Liddell talked about a final report from the state's hemp task force and the future of the product here in the islands. He highlighted a test plot for industrial hemp here on Oahu and talked to Scotty Wong about the possibilities for growing hemp seeds, much like we do corn seeds currently. Today, we hear from Joe Smith of Hemp Homes Hawaii, who built a hemp house for Maui resident John Woodhouse. We start off with Smith about how this effort got started.
We have a construction company, and we did mostly commercial buildings. So, you know, we did Hawaiian Telcom's offices here, and we did Pepsi's offices. The last job that we did under that general contracting license was the trampoline park here on Maui. And I built a few homes around. I did some residential homes, Kapalua Plantation Estates. I built homes Pukalani. So, you know, we were in the industry. And then we got a piece of land over here in Kula. We CPR'd the property. We share the property with John. It's his house that we built on this piece of property that we share. I knew about hempcrete. I knew about hemp as a building material. I knew of all the benefits of it, but I really didn't know how to build a house with hempcrete. So that last job that we did, the trampoline park, that was kind of the end of that company. We were going to retire and we're going to build our own house here on the property. And so how do we want to build a house? I mean, I'm painfully aware of just standard building practices. You use a lot of toxic materials, and this is green building at its best and really healthy living environment. I guess John could attest to that. But how to do it, I ended up going to Idaho and taking a workshop that was four contractors for a week. And then when we came back here, we retained an architect who became a hemp builder on the mainland, and he ran a workshop here where we learned a little more and we were teaching people how to build with hemp. And so, you know, it went on. We ended up doing our own little workshop. We built these little 120 square foot structures. And then finally, because I have a general contractor's license, I went to the building plans department, building plans review. I met with him, told him what we're doing. I had to give him a few things. You know, I got him some documentation, and they approved to build John's house.
Well, John, jump in here. You know, I mean, you decided to be a guinea pig.
Yeah, I decided. It took a little bit of a stretch because it is a little more expensive to build. And, you know, I'm basically on a pension and social security. But Joe convinced me that hemp was the way to go. And I am so grateful that we persevered and we did it, because there's something palpable about the energy in a hemp house. It's not like a regular house, and you can only really experience it by being in it. But there's sort of a stillness. There's really, it's someone built one on the mainland and said it was like being in a chapel or something. And so you're in this healthy environment. As Joe mentioned, you know, a lot of building materials are toxic, particularly drywall. I feel so grateful to have this beautiful hemp house on Maui.
Well, you helped to build it, but I guess explain to our listeners this idea of hempcrete. I mean, where did you get the hemp? How did this all come together?
So we bought the hemp from Kansas. You know, we took a step forward. So once we really decided we were going to build with hemp, it was really, part of the motivation was really to show people it could be done. We bought a 40-foot container of hemp that came from Kansas. We bought a 20-foot container of lime. You mix hemp, what they call hemp herd or hemp shiv. It's little chips of the hemp plant stalk, and you mix it with lime and water, hydrated lime and water, and there's a few minerals that are added to it to help the process. And they call it hempcrete, but it's kind of a misnomer. It should be called limecrete probably. And you build a form around the frame structure, and you fill the form with hemp, and it becomes your wall. We plaster the inside and the outside with a lime-based plaster, which is simply lime and sand, and it becomes a like a stucco look, but it doesn't have any cement in it. It's a very interesting dynamic. The walls breathe. They're vapor permeable, and they the way they transmit heat and humidity, it's a very interesting concept. So it kind of goes against normal building practices.
Yeah, the wall tree absorbs CO2. Which is amazing, one of the qualities of the hempcrete.
So this idea of hemp, I was reading that you can use 3D printing with it.
That's extremely new. I'm looking into that currently. It's really brand new. I mean, they're 3D printing things all over the place, mostly with concrete. And they're working on, you know, the mixture of hempcrete, and it's why I said it's a misnomer. It's really not anything like concrete. It's more like baking a cake than it is pouring concrete, you know. It has a lot thicker consistency. It doesn't really exactly pour. You have to get it in there and you have to pat it down a little. It's a little labor intensive, but it's well worth it. I mean, it's the healthy living environment. It's the green building. John was just saying it pulls CO2 out of the air for the next 20 years. And the thing that I was telling before is the final coat is not the hemp. It is a lime and sand plaster. And so the house looks like stucco.
It looks beautiful.
I found this non-toxic paint color pigment on the mainland. And so three of my walls actually have a color tint to them that was added to the plaster, to the lime plaster.
And so how do you like living in it?
I absolutely love it. I feel very, very blessed that Joe was able to build it and I'm able to live in it. And and I love showing people. I have some musician friends like Keola Beamer came up and Henry Capono came up and Lucas Nelson. And I love showing my house to people.
Well, from what I understand, like the fibers of hemp, I was reading that what they were used in cars early on.
Yeah, yeah. They built Henry Ford, right? Yeah.
They've built a plane out of hemp today. There's a plane right now, structure of the plane.
Wow.
Built out of hemp. You know, I was listening to Scotty, who you had on yesterday, and we're doing a similar thing here now because this whole thing is extremely viable here on Maui if we just grow hemp here. And he mentioned, or I think your reporter mentioned, that we need the decortication machine. I'm not a farmer, but it looks like I'm going to have to get into this a little bit. And I have someone who's agreed, who has a license to grow hemp here, and she also has a license to process hemp. And I just bought 2.5 million seeds, and we're going to start planting seeds just like Scotty did over there with a similar cultivar, because he mentioned about how the plant here in Hawaii, we can get 3 crops out of because we can grow year-round. Well, this thing is a no-brainer to grow the hemp here and everything that we can do with it. And I was really glad that they formed that hemp task force that you reported on yesterday, and I was a part of that, but I was the only one in the building sector. And most of those people were very interested in CBD,
mm-hmm.
and they're growing that here now. But where the money is, ultimately, it really is in industrial hemp, in fiber. We can make clothes, we can make plates, we can make utensils, and we can build houses.
There are many people who think we should put some of our eggs in this basket, that if we're looking at innovation and diversity, that this might be the crop to do it with. I mean, certainly with what we saw happen with the wildfires, I mean, if this product is fire resistant, that would, you know, be a plus. And the fact that Maui County, you know, is really trying to expedite the building of homes, that maybe the time is ripe that people are willing to entertain this idea and give it a go.
When I interviewed Cynthia, that was one of her main things. She was trying to emphasize that why aren't they looking at hemp for Lahaina?
Are you talking former Representative Cynthia Thielen?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I actually have right now a husband and wife in Lahaina, in the burn zone, that we are drawing up. We're doing the drawings for a hemp house there right now. In fact, they're going to be submitted to the county probably by the end of this week. But we're going to be building a hemp home in Lahaina.
Wow, that'll be terrific. And then we'll see where this goes.
And we'll see where this goes. You know, hopefully the task force will have some influence on the legislature, and they will start moving in this direction. But until they do, we're going to move forward. Someone said to me, just keep buying your hemp from Kansas until they grow it here, because it's got to happen eventually. We formed a new company, Hemp Home Hawaii, and we have several different people, mostly as a result of John's article, that want to build hemp houses.
People just need to be educated about what's out there and what's possible.
Exactly. That's exactly what needs to happen. There's a lot of people that got involved. We had so many people come over and look at the house. You know, what is the representative over on Lanai? Gabe Johnson came over to see the house. He's our local representative from Lanai. So there's a lot of people interested. The county seems to be interested. I'm curious to see. You know, it just got such a bad rap with the whole pot scene.
Yes, it's the cousin, but people just can't see the forest for the trees. There are possibilities with hemp.
Yeah, you know, where I took the workshop, there's a company called Hempitexture in Idaho, and they're actually making hemp insulation now, which is another great idea, which is something we could do here. But he said that that hemp is pot's sober cousin.
There you go. We got to put it to work.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. Pot's sober cousin. That was Joe Smith of Hemp Homes Hawaii and John Woodhouse, the proud new owner of a hemp house in Maui. Woodhouse penned an article for Maui News. We'll have a link to it on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
On the next Fresh Air, Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She's written a new memoir that gives us a rare glimpse into her legal mind, detailing her life and the experiences that led her to become the first Black woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The book is called Lovely One. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses such as art, film, history, and gardening. Classes begin September 23rd. More by searching OLLIUHM.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and on today's Manu Minute, we're hearing from the Kaloa Maoli, Hawaii's endemic duck. These quacks are brought to you by Zeno Canto and University of Hawaii at Hilo Biology Professor Patrick Hart.
Kaloa Maoli, or the Hawaiian duck, is found only in Hawaii. And is the only native duck species still present in the main Hawaiian islands. They're very close relatives of the mallard ducks that are commonly fed by children in public ponds and lakes. Unlike mallards, though, male and female Kaloa Maoli are harder to tell apart. Both sexes have orange legs and feet and an overall mottled brown body. They also have greenish-blue patch of wing feathers known as a speculum, that is easily seen when they're swimming. Adult males are usually darker overall and have a brown bill, while females have a dull orange bill. So, if you see a pair of ducks that are similar looking and look like female mallards, there's a good chance you're looking at native Hawaiian ducks. Kaloa Maoli quack in a similar way to mallards, and this quack may have played an important role in Hawaiian history. It's said that Imai Kalani, the fierce Ali'i warrior of Kau on Hawaii Island, was blind, but was aided in his battles by two Kaloa Maoli that would hover above and report to him through their quacks the direction of anyone approaching him in battle. He could then throw spears with deadly accuracy at his opponents. Kaloa Maoli eat a variety of aquatic plants, green algae, and aquatic invertebrates like mollusks, snails, and crustaceans. They were still abundant and regularly hunted across Hawaii until much of their habitat was drained and converted to sugar plantations by the end of the 1800s. This is also around the time that mongoose were introduced, which found these ground-nesting ducks to be easy prey. By the early 1900s, Kaloa Maoli were very difficult to find, and by 1962 there were fewer than 500 individuals left, restricted to the islands of Kauai and Niihau, which, non-coincidentally, were the only islands without mongoose. They were federally listed as an endangered species in 1967, soon after a captive breeding program began. Captive-bred birds were released on the Big Island, Maui, and Oahu. A few hundred still exist in upland ponds and streams on Hawaii Island, but the ones on Maui and Oahu have all interbred with introduced mallards, so mainly exist as Hawaiian duck hybrids. The best place nowadays to see non-hybrid Kaloa Maoli is the island of Kauai, where as many as 2,000 birds inhabit wetlands, ponds, and taro fields. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, working to protect Hawaii's native wildlife through programs and projects such as its Kolea Count. Learn more about programs and volunteering at HIAudubon.org.
In public radio, there's a phenomenon called the driveway moment. It's when you're driving somewhere and you reach your destination, but you linger in the car just so you can catch the end of a great story. Well, with the HPR mobile app, you can pick up that story anytime you want, replay national shows as well as local news stories, and make driveway moments a thing of the past. Get the HPR app in the App Store or on Google Play.
If you suffer from lower back pain, listen up. One Kailua, a physical therapist, is on a mission to help people alleviate their suffering. Her name is Christine Linders, and she recently wrote a book entitled The Proven Solution to Eliminate Low Back Pain Forever and Get a Flatter Stomach. Suck it in. I like that, suck it in. The Conversation's Russell Subiono has been preparing for a return to the gym and recently sat down with Linders in our studio to learn more about preventing lower back pain.
A lot of the causes of low back pain are just a loss of activation of the deep core muscles that stabilize your spine from the inside out. Other causes are things that we don't even realize. We're just sitting maybe more hunched, and your spine normally has a sloping S curve, but when you sit hunched, it turns into a C curve. Mm-hmm. So you end up getting a reversal of the low back curve, and that puts the spine at risk. It's not happy in its C curve, it's happy in its natural backwards curve, the way it is when you're standing up straight. And so when you start reversing that curve over time, collagen is laying down, your body's getting stiffer into that position, your muscles don't function the same way in that way. And then you go back to the gym or swimming sometimes, and you've lost the function. Also, people will bend over and pick up the dog bowl when their deep core has not been functioning well and throw out their back. It can be different things like that. But for your gym thing, losing some of the deep core function after one episode of back pain, those muscles become delayed in their function unless you retrain them. Wow. And that's some of the thing that I think is cool with you talking about going back to the gym. If you've ever had an episode of back pain, the deepest back muscles, the deep ones, not the superficial ones, they will delay in their firing. So if I was going to high five you right now, when my brain was like, I want to high five Russell, before my arm would reach, my deep core, my transverse abdominis, my deepest back muscles, pelvic floor, they would fire quickly and stabilize my low back to give my spine stability and my body stability to move and high five you. But in people with low back pain, they prove that there's this fraction of a second of a delay. So my hand goes up and then it fires. And that's where people will get recurrent low back pain. You want it to turn on first to stabilize you. And then once it kicks in, like once you go back to the gym and you're working again and it kicks in, now you're okay. But to avoid the vulnerability of not having your stable spine while you're starting to lift, that's where you want to retrain the deep core muscles.
I don't know that I've thrown on my back, but I for sure have bent over to pick something up, like groceries or a kid or something, and I definitely have pulled a muscle. And so when we talk about low back pain, are we generally talking about a muscle issue or a spinal issue, or is it both?
That's a great question. Loaded question, too, because it could be spinal issue if you've been hunching over a desk or your job has lent you to have to be bent over all the time, and now the structure of your spine has become stiff in an abnormal position. It could be a muscular issue if your superficial back muscles, the ones that tend to spasm when you just bend over to pick up groceries, if those have been used all the time from bending over gardening in a suboptimal way, then it can be a muscle issue. So it's kind of wound in between the two of structure and muscles. But I think that our bodies are bent to move, and your low back is meant to go forward, backward, not really to twist. And so some can be structure and some can be muscle. But if you can manage your body and work on having it in a better posture more of the time, like a lot of us sit. So if you sit, you know, supported with a pillow so you can maintain the curve, then your structure stays good most of the time. But if you're slouched and then your body develops that pattern of normal, like that feels straight, even though I take a picture of people and show that it's not, then you're in an abnormal structure and you go to bend over to pick up the grocery and you're more vulnerable to have an injury.
So is the solution really just sucking it in? Or what does that mean?
So the reason why I say suck it in as the proven solution to eliminate low back pain forever is because without having the proper activation, reactivation, or reigniting of those deep core muscles, it's impossible to get rid of your back pain forever. You need to reteach those muscles how to work. So that is not the only solution. If you are super structurally stiff, you'll need to work on your posture too, and maybe stretch out your hamstrings if they're extra tight, like really, really tight. Those are some of those other things that need to happen. And that's why I put a lot of other chapters in the book. If you suck your stomach in before you bend, before you get out of bed, before you get in and out of your car, before you bend to wash your face, before you reach to open the fridge and you start turning it on, every one of my patients comes back in and says, regardless if it's their first session, and I still have to work on their posture and their hamstring length and all that other thing, they always say, that is amazing. When I suck it in and do whatever it is that they have pain, getting in and out of the car or get out of bed, my back doesn't hurt. That's amazing. And they'll say, you know, hey, it still hurts when I go for long walks now. But when I suck it in first, that's amazing. That's what works. But that's not the cure for all those other things that they need to work on. But it is the start. 80% of people have back pain. I want them to know that they have this internal powerhouse that if they pull their belly button in, it doesn't even stop me from talking when I do it. And I've just given myself the anatomical girdle so I can stabilize my low back and get out of pain, retrain that to stabilize my spine. And that's been my mission, to get that out. Like before you bend over to adjust the bench at the gym, suck your stomach in, you just stabilize your spine. Before you go and set the weight for the lat pull down bar, you know, suck it in, bend over, put the pin in, then you grab the weights. It's always great to activate that first.
Is it really where if you do an inhale and you physically have your belly button retract into itself, or is it also like a tightening of the ab muscles as if somebody was going to punch you? Can you describe what it feels like or what you're trying to activate when you suck it in?
So it's not an inhale. Okay. You don't want to inhale when you do that.
Okay.
And the tightening your abs is like a brace. You can kind of hear my voice change.
Right.
So it's all about what they call intra-abdominal pressure, and that's the amount of pressure that's kind of in your torso cavity. And so like if you've ever heard tennis players go, you know, they're increasing intra-abdominal pressure to make their torso rigid so they can deliver a lot of force to the ball. That's bracing. When I say suck it in, I mean literally like sucking your stomach in, like if you were going to zip up a tight pair of pants, or you can't, you put them in the dryer and you can't quite button them and you have to like pull your belly button in, right? So you're not going inhaling, because then you increase the size of your rib cage, is harder to zip up those tight pair of pants. So the belly button in, if you're going to do it, you would want to do it on an exhale.
Okay.
So if for some people that have trouble just pulling their belly button in like that and making their tummy look smaller, or zipping up the tight pair of pants, or squeezing between two people at a packed concert, then you would make your abdomen look leaner from the side. And I will tell people, if you can't do that, then you can take a deep breath in. And then when you exhale, on the bottom of your exhale, as you go, you pull your belly button in. Because the transverse abdominis is what I'm having people activate when they pull their belly button in or when they suck it in. As soon as you turn your transverse abdominis on, it wraps on the sides of your body like a torso right here. It's the deepest abdominal muscle. That muscle connects with the multifidus in the back. Those are those deepest back muscles that stabilize your spine, and that's what we want. Those are the ones that stabilize your spine. But when you pull your belly button in, they turn on and give you an anatomical girdle. So inhale, bottom of the exhale, you pull your belly button in as you breathe.
When somebody starts implementing this regimen to strengthen their deep core, are there other beneficial effects that happen to your body outside of just back pain relief? Are there other benefits to strengthening your deep core?
There's so many benefits to strengthening your deep core. One of them I put on the front of the book, gaining a flatter stomach. Mm-hmm. That was the aside, because I thought it was very interesting. I started teaching this technique, and I think 2003, maybe. I didn't even learn about it in PT school because that research came out right around where I graduated. And that's when, believe it or not, the internet came out. And so I started teaching this technique and I went to a big seminar and it was on women's health section, came out with the American Physical Therapy Association. And they were talking about women and how everybody was doing crunches after having a baby because they wanted to get rid of the baby bulge, you know, and they were talking about the transverse abdominis and how you actually, when you engage the transverse abdominis by what I call sucking in, I don't remember what they call drawing it in, I think it is, that it is what women want to do to get rid of that bulge because the crunches work the superficial ab, it can make it bulge more. The pulling in is what will stabilize your abdomen from the inside out. And so the other thing too is as we age, all of our abdominal contents are in there and your transverse abdominis is here wrapping sideways like a corset. So when you strengthen your deep core, that actually supports your abdominal contents. So it does give you the flatter belly appearance.
Okay.
And that's just one thing. The other thing is we derive, like, our arms and legs, wrists, elbows, shoulders, hips, knees, and ankles. They need the central stability of our torso to not get injured. So you will have better balance if you strengthen your deep core. You will sprain your ankle less if you have a strong core. When you go to reach and grab a pot off the stove that's heavy, your arm has more support if you have a strong deep core than if your core is not strong. People will get more injuries in their extremities, which I find fascinating.
Again, the book is called The Proven Solution to Eliminate Low Back Pain Forever and Get a Flatter Stomach.
Yes. <that's
laughs> Suck it in. What prompted you to write the book?
My inspiration was my patients. I was living in New York City and then Connecticut back to back, and I was teaching people how to suck it in. And they would all say, like, well, people taught me how to do this, like, flatten your back. And I said, you know, don't do that. I didn't want them to take the low back curve out of its happy place. I wanted the multifidus to fire. And just try it, please, and let me know. And they would come back and say, like, wow, that really worked. Like, I wish I knew this years ago because I wouldn't have had back pain all these years. And then I moved to Connecticut, and about four people in a week, I think, or two's time, it was 2016, said the same thing to me, like that same story, and said, well, you should write a book because I would get it. And I was like, really? They're like, just write a book on it and then we all can learn. And that's just my passion, is I want people to know that they have this in their back pocket that they can just suck it in and really support their back and improve their balance and get a flatter stomach, right? You said the title exactly like I say it.
Christine Linders, thank you so much for coming into the studio this morning. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, Russell. This was great. I enjoyed this as well.
That was physical therapist Christine Linders talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Linders' book is called The Proven Solution to Eliminate Low Back Pain Forever and Get a Flatter Stomach, Suck It In. That book is available through Archway Publishing and from major online booksellers. We'll have a link to more information and a demonstration video on the conversation page of our website later today. Well, that does it for us for right now, but up tomorrow we learn more about the Pacific Gateway Center and how for the last 50 years it has been helping those new to the islands stand on their own. Do you have an immigrant story to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.